This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. So today is the day of the Georgia Senate runoffs, a vote that Trump described in his rally in Dalton, Georgia yesterday with Kelly Loeffler. Of course, David Perdue is in quarantine because of COVID exposure. Did President Trump as perhaps the most important vote Georgians will cast in their lifetimes. We'll get to that momentarily. But I want to start because this impacts not only what happens in Georgia today, but it's sort of a cascading effect. The challenges to the outcome in Georgia on November 3rd impact what happens today in Georgia, impacts what happens tomorrow as the Congress, it's turned over to Congress to certify the state electoral counts. So Brad Raffensperger, the Secretary of State,
starting to bother me, isn't he? Starting to bother you? He's so squirrely.
He was squirrely with Martha McCallum yesterday. So following up on the conversation that he had and their respective legal teams with President Trump over the weekend, that the audio of which was released to the Washington Post, and obviously it was released by Raffensperger's side, that was sort of the thrust of the conversation with McCallum, in addition to just sort of disputing the counts that the Trump legal team has versus the counts that the Secretary of State's office has, and saying, declaring, sort of declarative statement that we ran a fair election, we have an accurate count, and President Trump has inaccurate numbers. And the point, as we discussed yesterday, that Trump's attorneys, including Cleta Mitchell, made is, I know you keep saying that, but could you take our certified data that we have run through experts and have audited and bump that up against your data that we don't have access to give us a definitive answer? And then we can say jointly that this has occurred and this is the final answer, and people can have confidence one way or the other in the outcome, or perhaps more confidence at minimum. Well, that hasn't happened yet. It doesn't appear that it's going to happen. And Raffensperger was...
Well, he was on the defense yesterday because he was, you know, it wasn't me. Well, I didn't release the tape. It was, that's what he said to NBC, saying it wasn't him. But who else could it be if it's not him?
Well, that's not what he said to Martha McCallum.
Oh.
And he was a bit defiant, but also, and McCallum picked up on this, it seems like it's a bit personal now between Raffensperger and Trump, as well as between Raffensperger and, for example, Senator Perdue. Raffensperger, the question put to him by McCallum, did you release the phone call and why?
It's out there, and it is what it is.
That's not an answer to my question. Are you going to answer my question? Were you aware of the decision, and were you in favor of the decision to release the phone call, sir?
I think that we had to respond to the president's Twitter, and we responded with the facts that were in the call, and that's how it got out there.
Okay.
So now the world can just see what was in there. They can make up their own decisions, listen to the whole thing, both sides of the aisle, right down the middle, and they can make their own decisions.
Okay, so that's a concession that he knew about it, and he okayed the release of the phone call. So that's what happened. Obviously, it's what happened, and you know, Mark McCallum had to press him to get that answer. So to your point about him being squirrely, if it was compelled by President Trump tweeting about the conversation on Sunday that you all had on Saturday, then why be squirrely about it? Say, hey, you're gosh darn right I released that call.
Yeah.
You're gosh darn right I called for that code red. And the reason is because of what Trump said that was inaccurate, but he's squirrely about it.
Well, this is what he said to NBC. He said he didn't do it.
I don't know how it got released, but at the end of the day, what he said was not factually correct. And I want to make sure that people understand the facts.
Well,
Pick a story and stick with it, dude. My God.
If you want to be a truth teller, then you have to tell the truth.
Exactly.
I know that sounds a bit tautological, but if you can't tell the truth about the release of the audio that clearly came from your office and per the discussion with the Callum, clearly with your knowledge and thus assent, then I don't know. It sort of calls into question how honest you're being about other matters. He also responded to McCallum asking him about Senator David Perdue's comments that the release of said phone call was malicious and a poor decision.
The issues that President Trump has been raising about all of his contentions that he didn't have a fair vote here in Georgia, that has been a major distraction for the two senators to be able to run their race. In fact, he's in effect been suppressing Republican turnout. And so we need to really have a strong Republican turnout. I believe that if you listen to that tape, you'll believe that President Trump's big focus is not tomorrow. It's actually Wednesday, January 6th.
Well, I mean, that may be what his focus is, and we're going to learn more when we see him at the rally this evening. But I just want to ask you once again to respond specifically to Senator Perdue, who said that he thought it was inappropriate and disgusting to release this audio. How do you respond to him on that charge?
Senator Perdue still owes my wife an apology for all the death threats she got after he asked for my resignation. And I've not heard one peep from that man since. And he wants to call me face to face, man to man. I'll talk to him off the record, but he hasn't done that.
And then I'll release the call of that conversation after we talk off the record, right? Just a Raffensperger.
Meet the bike racks. Let's go.
So two things. One is, Senator Perdue calls for your resignation. Some person or persons allegedly make death threats against your wife. Senator Perdue is responsible for that? No, he's not. That's childish.
Yeah.
And that's a misdirection play. In addition to that, what he said about President Trump, you know, being the focus of, is Wednesday, not Tuesday. Well, he was on effectively a settlement call with you about litigation that the Trump campaign has filed with respect to Georgia's administration of the election. So, of course, he's talking about November 3rd. By the way, you'll note, Secretary of State Raffensperger, that he was hosting a rally last night, as he did, with 25,000 people, million tuning in online, to rally the vote for Loeffler and Perdue. So, I mean, for him to sit back and say, well, Perdue owes me my wife an apology because somebody allegedly says something to her, that has nothing to do with David Perdue. It's not his fault, but how people react to his call for a public act, which is a resignation. And then President Trump is not worried about the senators. He's suppressing the vote. If there's anything that is suppressive of Republican vote in Georgia, it's the lack of confidence in his office's administration of the election on November 3rd, isn't it? I mean, so, you know, and you know, the attempt to offload blame, if there is blame to offload, depending on the outcome today, onto Trump for the outcome for these Senate races, in addition to, you know, trying to sort of come over the top at Perdue with moral indignation, you know, that's the sort of, those are sort of time worn and frankly tired.
And I love that Senator Perdue last night just didn't let off the gas when it comes to Raffensperger.
And I'm still shocked that a member of the Republican Party would tape a sitting president and then leak that. It's disgusting in my view.
Yeah, he should resign.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636DA, turnkey.pro text line. We'll take your calls on this, and when we come back, we'll get to some of the key takeaways from that Trump rally in Dalton, Georgia last night. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
Before you see it on TV, share it on Facebook, or read about it in the paper, hear it here first. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Oh, there you are.
That dance you did to the music is really impressive, Dan.
Yeah, so Dan and Amy back. Some technical difficulties we're working through, so sorry about that. Trump in Dalton, Georgia yesterday rallying the faithful, but before he spoke, Vice President Mike Pence did, and he had this to say about January 6th, tomorrow.
You know, I know we all got our doubts about the last election, and I want to assure you I share the concerns of millions of Americans about voting irregularities. And I promise you, come this Wednesday, we'll have our day in Congress. We'll hear the objections. We'll hear the evidence. But tomorrow is Georgia's day.
It's America First with me, Sebastian Gorka.
Oh, Sebastian Gorka, kicker. I didn't know that it was a two-man act yesterday. I think it was just Mike Pence.
Yeah, it was just
Mike. So anyway, Pence suggesting, you know, we'll have our day tomorrow. But that is not the same thing as to say that Pence is going to intercede in some material way. I don't know if people have a real appreciation for the limitations of what the president of the Senate, Mike Pence, the vice president of the United States, can do in the January 6th proceeding where Congress is tasked per the 12th Amendment to count the electoral votes that have been sent from the 50 states. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36DA, turnkey.pro text line, because the big takeaway on matters other than the Georgia Senate races from last night's rally was President Trump making a statement that he is counting on Mike Pence to do something that, and I don't know what that is. His position, as I said, is largely ceremonial. We'll discuss more detail with Andy McCarthy at the top of the 7 o'clock hour. But
President Trump
trying to interpret what President Trump was insinuating.
Yeah, insinuating he needs to do his job, and the crowd cheered.
Nothing the radical Democrats will not do to get power that they so desperately crave, even the outright stealing of elections like they're trying to do with us. We're not going to let it happen over the past. And I hope Mike Pence comes through for us, I have to tell you. I hope that our great vice president comes through for us. He's a great guy. Of course, if he doesn't come through, I won't like him quite as much. No, Mike is a great guy. He's a wonderful man and a smart man and a man that I like a lot. But he's going to have a lot to say about it. And you know one thing with him, you're going to get straight shots. He's going to call it straight.
Yeah, but he's not going to have a lot to say about it.
Right.
He's not going to have a lot to say about it. That's not true. So I don't know what extra constitutional action anyone expects Mike Pence to take. But the various arguments that have been made, whether it's Louis Gohmert's lawsuit or whether it's President Trump's general comments yesterday, Mike Pence is not going to and cannot legitimately say, no, I'm not going to accept the electors from Pennsylvania, from Georgia, from Wisconsin, from Nevada, from Arizona, from Michigan. I'm not going to accept them.
He doesn't have the power to do that.
So
what exactly is going to happen tomorrow? I mean, they're going to force an up and down vote on whether President-elect Joe Biden won and have discussions?
No, it's not an upper—no. The electors, the slates of electors that have been sent by the states will be counted by the Congress, and per the Election Count Act of 1887, there's a process by which members of Congress can lodge objections, and that's what we've been talking about and you've been hearing about since last week from Howley, from some Republican senators, from many members of the House Republican Caucus as well. And so, so this is a matter for Congress to take up, to count and certify, but it is not to overturn what the states have provided. As Ted Cruz articulated on Maria Bartiromo's show on Sunday, here's what we suggest. We want an audit, a 10-day audit, a bipartisan commission to audit the results. Okay. So you have to persuade a majority of your colleagues in both chambers in order to pursue that action. January 20th is constitutionally mandated. January 6th is not per se. And so if you could persuade your colleagues to do that, then you could go off on that go off on that path. And then, you know, Cruz suggested, well, if there's material evidence of fraud that occurred in a particular state such that it would change the outcome, then arguably, and this would be litigated, this would be wild, there would be some state action that would be required to remedy the infirmity that this bipartisan election commission would found. I mean, this is sensational stuff. So let's just take a step back and recall what we were saying from November 3rd forward, which is, you know, you're on these clocks.
Right.
You're on a December 14th clock. Now you're on a January 6th clock. Now you're on a January 20th clock. And as you move along, your options are diminished. And so from the states certifying their slates of electors to where we are today, or on the cusp of tomorrow, with Congress counting those votes and certifying at the federal level what the states provided, and then the constitutionally mandated inauguration per the end of the term of the incumbent president and vice president on January 20th. So I don't know why people, I mean, I understand the frustration and I understand the substantive arguments, but you can't be surprised and you can't ascribe blame to Mike Pence for what hasn't been accomplished up to November 3rd and then from November 3rd to tomorrow. You can't expect, what do you expect him to intervene in a way that
wave
beyond
a magic wand.
His constitutional power to do so. Is that what people expect?
312,
I don't think so.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
Tom in Deer Park, here on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey Dan and Amy, Happy New Year, good morning. You think that Apple and Bitcoin had a good year. Anti-Trump, never Trump, whatever you want to call us, had the best possible year and surpassed them by any measure. Donald Trump was on tape trying to steal the election. So, in my mind, Ross,
where was that?
He's a stand-up hero.
Where was that?
He needed 11,780 votes. Find him somewhere. Just find him. And then he threatened him on tape.
You're wrong.
That's what happened. I heard, listen to the tape.
No,
it isn't.
Tom, you're wildly wrong about that call with Raffensperger, but go ahead.
Look, I know. Look, I know. Oh, Dan, Amy, I know you got to do the Mark.
No. I'm not taking. I'm not taking any marching orders. And I articulated the point about that call yesterday. If you want me to do it again, I will.
I listened to it.
Yeah. Did you listen to the lawyers as well? Did you listen to Cleta Mitchell? Did you listen?
She made a fool of herself and read her timeline. She's going to be the next Lynn Wood Crocking lady. She's nuts.
And no, she's
she
not.
Might wind up.
No. Actually,
she's the most sound voice on that.
Actually, Tom, you're nuts, and you could listen to the call, but you didn't hear it. The details that were provided. There's disputes between the numbers of how many people voted who were dead, how many people voted who were out of state. Is there some explanation for that? No longer residents of the state is what I mean. And the lawyers said, essentially, you tell us these things, but you won't show your work. You just say, we say that they're true, and you're to trust us because they're true. We have our own work product that's been audited, and we want to bump up our information against your information. And if you actually heard what you claim you listened to, Tom, from Deer Park, then you would have heard the lawyers very reasonably put forward the idea that we have four just buckets that the president articulated during that hour-long call. It's kind of roughly 24,000 votes. If we could just get you to take those 24,000 votes, that cohort of votes that we think were illegally counted.
Connect with Dan.
And bump those up against the information that you have that we don't about things like residency for a particular subset of that vote. The obituaries that we were using to match up against the voter file versus what information you have about the living in your data. Then we would get some resolution to this dispute. And then, hey, if they're there, they're there. And if they're not, they're not. That's what the attorney said.
Well, and there's still 1,700 votes of people who voted twice that they haven't taken off the voter totals.
Well, okay, so that's one subset.
So obvious.
So the point is, he was not saying go find 11,780 votes, you know, wherever you find them. No, he was saying I won the state by 500,000 votes, which that's fine. You want to dispute that, and all you and then the lawyer said all you need to do is just take four of the buckets that the president outlined, the president identified, and use those counts to bump up against the data that you have that you won't disclose to us because you say you can't under Georgia state law, and get us an answer. And whatever the answer is, we'll accept. That's what was actually said. All of your bloviations are just so much CNN propaganda, Tom from Tierbark. Mike in Plano.
Hey, when Raffensperger said Trump was a distraction from the Senate race, that's a nonsense talking point from the establishment GOP. Karl Rove said it yesterday, too. And all those guys are still chasing the suburban soccer mom vote. You know, the women that drive around SUVs with masks on their face. They're not voting Republican, folks. In order to win that race, you got to maximize the Trump voter. And unfortunately, both those candidates are a couple boring, uninspiring, lousy candidates. The only way they'll win is because of Trump and because of his rally and his ability to maximize the vote, because they can't say they're against socialism when they're voting for $2.3 trillion omnibus bills, which fund elite institutions and give us peasants $600. Thanks, guys.
All right. Thanks for the call, Mike. Although there is some consideration that has to be paid, perhaps in postmortem, to how a soy boy like John Ossoff and a pro-abortion reverend anti-Semite could be in a dead heat, could be threatening to win two Senate seats in the state of Georgia. It's not just the Zuckerberg boxes and frauding the vote.
I don't know if people realize
there's a lot at stake. The question is, how can a Ralph Warnock?
How can
a John Ossoff as well in Georgia be positioned to win two Senate seats? That requires a more textured thinking than just saying, you know, Loeffler is sort of a boring talking points candidate, and so is David Perdue. By the way, David Perdue has been, pretty close. I don't know if there's another one, the closest senator to Trump during the last 4 years. So, you know, the fact that he's some sort of state establishment type, despite perhaps his persona, doesn't really fit with how he's comported himself in the Senate. You'll take judicial notice of. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
AM 560, The Answer mobile app. Just text the word app to 64636 to download the app today.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. In June of this year, a study of lockdowns in Europe looked at interventions imposed by 11 European countries and the assertion that those interventions, lockdowns, save millions of lives. We show that their methods involve circular reasoning. The purported effects are pure artifacts, which contradict the data. Moreover, we demonstrate that the United Kingdom's lockdown was both superfluous and ineffective. This is a part of an inventory of studies on lockdowns that you can find at the American Institute for Economic Research, which I will tweet out at Dan Proft and parlor out at Dan Proft too, if that's the right word.
Oh, you're on
parlay out. And that so despite this evidence about the ineffectiveness of lockdowns, and we'll talk to Alex Berenson, former New York Times reporter, a little bit later on the show about this. Despite the evidence of the ineffectiveness of lockdowns in terms of stopping the spread, controlling the virus, and despite the associated costs of lockdowns that are much more quantifiable, not model-based, real-world-based, where do we find ourselves in places like, well, the UK? We find ourselves with Boris Johnson, Bojo, announcing that the English should stay in their flats until mid-February now.
You may only leave home for limited reasons permitted in law, such as to shop for essentials, to work if you absolutely cannot work from home, to exercise, to seek medical assistance.
And it he says it's a month, but it he even said later that, you know, not on camera, that if he has to, he'll extend it another month or a few weeks. So, I mean, who's had enough? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment. And I know we don't have that here, but Lord knows, we can, you know, we live day to day not knowing what's going to happen next, when regulations and tiers are going to be lifted, or when we're going to be able to go back to the gym and do group exercise or have our kids play travel sports.
British Health Secretary Matt Hancock, their version of Tony Fauci, said that, and this is classic, this is just right from the playbook. Everyone in the country should behave as if they have the virus.
Even healthy people who've worked out their whole lives and do the right things, and we wash our hands. You said that. Everyone should pretend that they have it. Okay.
Okay, so if everyone should pretend that they have it, then that means everyone should pretend that they're immune or soon to be.
Yeah, good point.
isn't that right? Yeah, everyone should behave as if they have the virus. You know, this is reminiscent of Tony Fauci, since he has a long track record in public health in this country. I think we've mentioned this before, but his track record being wrong is not limited to COVID. If you go back to the outbreak of HIV.
Oh, yeah. Remember what he said?
Tony Fauci suggested that it was possible that HIV could be transmitted casually.
Right. That it was airborne. Yeah. Droplets.
And that and there was real sensitivity, because they're in the business of managing people, not telling the truth. Real sensitivity to telling the truth about HIV transmission, because didn't want to stigmatize intravenous drug users or gay men. And you know who got tired of that propagandizing, that dishonesty?
Who?
Gay men. And they started to say and demand, wait a second, this is impacting our community, and there's not enough focus on our community, because we're the ones that are suffering as a result of the transmission of this disease. And that really, it was, I think if you go back and look, it was properly attributed to gay activists who focused people's attention on where transmission was actually occurring, and focused people's attention on the sort of funding levels and initiative to develop treatments, if not a cure. But Tony Fauci was not ahead of the learning curve there. He wasn't. And with Tony Fauci, and I'm going to assume public health politicians like this Hancock guy over in the UK, what they do, they're not saying, hey, here's some questions we are seeking answers to. Here's what we know. Here's what we don't know. So we're taking a measured approach. That's not what they're saying. They're saying, I have an idea in my head, but I'm going to parcel it out such that I think the public will accept it, so that I can bring them along to what I want to do policy-wise. And that includes the politicians, because they are politicians, and this is their opportunity. Some of them are, not all public health officials, of course, not all medical professionals. But these individuals, I think there's enough of a track record in the last 10 months, much less the last 40 years, to support that contention. And remember, just in the last 10 months, Tony Fauci's done this before in terms of saying things that either he knew to be untrue then, or he's saying things he knows to be untrue now. He can't have it both ways on matters like masks. And so this is the same thing that you get in the UK. And the demand to respond to any of the studies that have been done or any of the things that lockdowners have been wrong about, demonstrably wrong about over the last 10 months? No. There is no accountability there because, of course, you have a DC press corps or an establishment press corps globally in the West that supports the policy, has elevated these individuals to oracle status, and they can't turn back now. I mean, how else do you explain this in part, at least in part explain this? You know what the support, and this is, remember, this is a country that had a bit of a revolt, I think you would argue, with Brexit. The popular support for this latest Bojo lockdown?
Bojo.
79% support, 16% oppose.
That, what?
79.
People are
YouGov
living in
poll,
fear.
79% support, 16% oppose. The only place there is less independent thinking than in the UK would be in Chicago.
Right. Oh, that's surprising. And one thing Boris Johnson's doing that's really pissing me off is he said back in when they sent kids back to school, he said, I will never do to the children what I did to them in March. But yet yesterday he closed all schools and universities. And people are just going along to get along and they're not going to protest? I doubt it. People are losing their lives and their livelihood more than their lives.
Well, there are protests that are happening. I mean, there was a protest over the weekend in Toronto demanding an end to COVID rules that I don't know, 500,000 people rallying in downtown Toronto said were an attack on their democracy. Well, socialist democracy such as it is, but I guess such as it is in much of America these days as well. It's just really something, isn't it?
Yeah.
Although Holman Jenkins makes the point in the Wall Street Journal that, to my Fauci criticisms, it's late in the day to discover that messaging has been going on. No, I know. We didn't just discover it here. Some people just discovered it with his Christmas Eve New York Times interview. But, of course, we've been talking about it largely since the outset.
Right.
40% of, you know, just some of the data points that nobody, well, that people that are committed to lockdowns don't care about. I mean, and I guess, look, if you're wearing a mask outside, then you're, you know, that's if you're trying to find, like, who are the people past the point of no return and who are the people that, you know, you can have a reasonable conversation with and maybe persuade to think more holistically about addressing this policy challenge.
Yeah.
This, if you see somebody wearing a mask outside or somebody wearing a mask while driving their car alone, then those people are past the point of no return. They're lost. They will not come back. It doesn't matter.
Right.
It doesn't matter how high you pile up the studies. It doesn't matter how much data you provide and distill, spoon feed. It won't matter. But it does matter to some people. Some people are persuadable. 40% of COVID cases are asymptomatic.
40%. Wow.
The range is ever moving around, and part of that is because, of course, we're relying on, or at least have to contemplate what they don't contemplate. They don't contemplate contradictory data at CDC or Tony Fauci land. We do. So CDC, NIH, you know, they give a range, but say 40% are asymptomatic. 80% of symptomatic cases are mild and indistinguishable from the cold or the flu. And so one of the things Jenkins makes the point is to say this whole test trace propaganda that you've heard for the last 10 months too, you know, politicians wanting to give the impression that they have a plan to control the virus and they're going to execute it and it's being executed and so on and so forth. So far, we have tested only about 80% of Americans even once. We'd have to test 330 million Americans every few days to catch a useful percentage of COVID cases while they're still infectious, given that data, 40% asymptomatic, 80% mild.
And 20 million
and then
people.
Contact, right. And then on top of that, contact tracing and the numbers are impossible. But because the strategy was useful in a South Korean context, our politicians go through the motions here. And that's exactly what happened. In another messaging snafu poked through last summer, CDC Director Robert Redfield admitted our testing might be catching only 10% of the cases.
Right. But they're not even factoring in antibody positive tests. And if they did that, then they would realize that 60 million Americans have had and have survived COVID.
Well, it's the same.
We should be celebrated, but not by not wearing masks.
We might be catching 10%. We might be catching 10% of the cases, said Redfield. But that was quickly sped past because we have to create this impression that we can bend nature to our will. Back to Holman Jenkins. Official lying about things large and small has been a staple of COVID politics. The letters to college students threatening them with arrest if they don't quarantine, the interstate travel bans that were never enforced, the death counts that swept up anybody who died with died of any cause while infected with COVID. And it began on day one. I don't go to the doctor for a cold or flu, and neither do 80 to 95% of you. This has implications. Once Wuhan hospitals were besieged with severe cases, it was a waste of time asking ourselves if the virus was here. It was here. The blocked flights, the testing of recent arrivals were so much hand-waving so our government could be seen as doing something. The reality? It would be up to us to control COVID the best we can. Lockdowns are imagined to be a kind of enforced social distancing, but they aren't. Mandatory business closures don't stop people from spreading the disease. Letting businesses stay open doesn't force them to spread the disease. People spread the disease by their own decisions, moment by moment, about when, where, and how to expose themselves to risk. Only lately has this reality snuck into public rhetoric as leaders in New York, Massachusetts, and elsewhere started admitting that their moves are more about signaling than any practical effect. Remember, Andrew Cuomo said that a couple of months ago. And again, quickly, that was sped by because you're not supposed to admit what you're doing when it's artifice. And this lost in all of the reflection on what has been done, to the extent that some people are reflective. We've talked about it here, but I don't even think we've emphasized it enough. Jenkins writing, no messaging strategy was more ill-judged than the one our politicians selected for a vaccine, deciding that there was nothing more important than signaling that no corners were being cut. In fact, we had highly promising candidates days after the virus was sequenced last January, a year ago. Operation Warp Speed was triumphant in compressing the normal development process in ways that wouldn't make sense with shareholder money. Indisputable now is that we should have junked the normal process and accepted more vaccine risk in return for the prospective benefit of saving thousands of lives and trillions of dollars in lost wages in 2020, particularly with respect to taking on more risk for those up in age who we know are wildly, wildly, exponentially more vulnerable than those under the age of 50.
We have a caller from Scotland, Dan.
Tim in Woodstock.
Hey, good morning, Dan and Amy. You know, I can remember hearing early on when this started in the UK that there was a point where the politicians wanted to do away with the lockdowns, but they'd already created a monster that they couldn't reel back in. And they were saying that there was so much popular support already for the lockdowns that they couldn't reverse what they were doing. And, you know, creating a fearful environment, I think it used to be something that we avoided, especially here in America. But today it really is used as a political tool, a political weapon to control people. And, you know, we know politicians aren't the most principled people. And once they understand what people are thinking, they're going to tend to keep promoting those same policies to just enhance themselves. And that's where we're at. We're at a yes. point where people want to be told by experts how to live their lives.
That's right. The idolatry of science. Thanks for the call, Tim. But the problem is that we find now that science in significant ways has been as corrupted as the political ruling class, or it's part of the political ruling class, which is to say it's corrupt. I mean, how else do you process the rescinding of studies published in these leading medical journals like The Lancet or the New England Journal of Medicine? They've had to rescind studies they published. They're focused on things like at New England Journal of Medicine, eliminating designations of gender on birth certificates, while they're publishing specious studies about how we're undercounting the deaths of people under the age of 40. This was recently. While in the same journal article, New England Journal of Medicine, conceding that an alternative explanation for some of the excess deaths under the age of 40 that we saw in 2020 could be opioid overdoses. Oh, really?
Oh, God.
It's COVID, because we need to create this, we need to propagate this idea that we all have COVID, to borrow from the good health secretary in the UK, Hancock, and that everybody is equally vulnerable, when everyone who wants to know does know that that is not the case.
Well, and I
goes
truly,
up by orders of magnitude with each age cohort.
I truly believe until they stop associating or attaching money to a COVID death, that this isn't going to end. I met a hospice nurse from Idaho. She was so upset, and I met her over winter break, and she said, every death I have to put down that it's a COVID death.
It's not money to a COVID death. It's money to COVID cases for the hospitals.
Right, but she has to write that down. She said, and I watch, and I refuse to do it, and I have had to take a leave. Because I'm done doing it.
Yeah, it's so much bigger than that. I mean, this is not because hospitals are incentivized to classify illnesses as COVID cases for the purposes of Medicare reimbursement. That's an issue. But I mean, this is so much bigger than that. What's going on? I mean, it is cultural. So it permeates everything. Kyle in Edinburgh, Scotland.
Hey, good morning, Dan and Amy. I listen to you guys. I'm a Chicago native. I listen to you guys every morning to keep in touch with what's happening in Chicagoland. And I want to say to you how accurate you are in your analysis of what's going on here in socialist communist Britain. I'm calling you from behind enemy lines in this country. I'm an eyewitness, and I cannot tell you what I do here, but because I'll be identified and the police will come knocking on my door. This is an unbelievably draconian place right now. Police are cracking down on anybody who's a dissident like me on anything that they say. In fact, right now, I'm watching the First Minister of Scotland, far-left Nicola Sturgeon. We call her Stinky Fish here, by the way. She is a cross, just to give you an idea, she's a cross between Mayor Lightfoot and Mayor de Blasio. That's who this woman is.
It's a bad cross.
She's right now talking to us, trying to justify why I can't go more than 1,000 meters from my home to do this and that, and only can go to a shop and a pharmacy. And again, the same mantra from last March, stay home, save lives. Nonsense. It's never worked. You're absolutely right. So I cannot even begin to tell you the things that are going on here. If you want to ask me a question, go ahead.
Well, what about hospitalizations? I know that the number of cases are up, but how many people are in hospital? How many are in ICU? Do they give you that information?
Well, that has gone up. I don't have the exact figures in front of me, but she's giving it. But I have to turn the volume down to talk to you. But they've gone up indeed. They have. The problem is that again, they refuse to tell us who are these people being hospitalized and who's dying. It's people over 65 and 70, but they're giving us the false impression that it's everybody's dying, from, you know, 5-year-old boys to 12-year-old girls, which is a lie. They refuse to tell us on TV who is dying. They, we can't give you that patient confidentiality. We're not looking for the names of the people. We just want to know what age they are. They refuse to tell us, which is part of the lie they're putting across. They're scaring the heck out of everybody in this country. I live in the sort of the outskirts of the city of Edinburgh, and it's a rural area. And just to give you an example how much they've scared people here, I see people living in this rural area walking around outdoors 24/7 with a mask on when there's nobody around. We're in a rural area. And when I ask them, why are you doing this, you should see the fear in their eyes. And they say to me, oh, well, I'm afraid. But you're just here by yourself. There's, it's not floating around the sheep and the cows out here.
Well, Boris Johnson, Boris Johnson said he's going to, people will remain in lockdown until they have vaccinated all people over 70 years old and all people in care homes. And thanks, they're going to have a month to do it.
Thanks for the call, Kyle. And meanwhile, a disabled veteran is tackled by police at a mall in San Antonio for not wearing a mask. People are pulled out of their homes in, I think it was Quebec, for having an illegal gathering of six people on New Year's Eve. And, of course, you have legislation in New York pending to open Cuomo COVID detention camps. Okay. Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, continuing our conversation on COVID, turning our attention again to the schools. I feel like we're sawing sawdust here, but apparently it needs to be sawed because we still have, of course, the Chicago Teachers Union resistant to returning to school. But it's not just it's not just Chicago, and it's not just the Chicago Teachers Union, and it's not just teachers unions even around the country, although they're the main culprits without question. It is a continuation of this idea that schools are incubators of spread, when the science, the research comporting with the scientific method, tells you 180 degrees the opposite.
But they're not listening.
Kate Osgood.
I'm sorry. Go on.
And so Kate Osgood, this apparently she's a Chicago public school teacher. What a remarkable post that you shared with me.
Oh yeah. She and other preschool teachers went in full hazmat gear. They were wearing PPE as if they were treating ICU patients on ventilators. They have lost their minds.
They were wearing outfits like they were walking on the surface of Mars.
It's ridiculous. And, you know, the post, too, that they put, you know, we're not going to stop. We're angry. That's what they put. Our pre-K team was told to report, so here we are. We're providing our own PPE, our own cleaning supplies out of our own pocket. We are scared. We are angry. We will be reporting all, in capitals, the gaps that exist in this terrible plan. We will protect our students. What? Protecting your students? You're spreading fear and panic in the community.
So the hashtag is safe return or no return. I'll tell you what, Katie Osgood, and you, CTU apparatchiks, you've convinced me. No return.
No return.
You're right. No return. I mean, it has nothing to do with COVID, but you have convinced me there is no reason to return kids to these schools and these people, at least some of them.
312. Yeah, 312-642-5600. Turnkey.pro answer line. I mean, is Dan right? Also, Katie Osgood, another post she put, I don't mean to brag or make anyone jealous, but I haven't purchased a single school supply all year. And she put that in capitals. I mean, these teachers are loving this. And there's, and besides that, at that elementary school, at a school called Brentano Elementary, Dan, they didn't go inside the school yesterday. They brought fire pits and hand warmers, and they did remote learning outside their school. One of them is this lovely lady named Kristen Roberts, preschool teacher, who will not, she should lose her job today.
For my family's health.
She's scared for her
family. We will not be going into our buildings to teach. We'll be continuing to teach remotely.
They refuse to go into the building. So according to Janice Jackson, if they refuse to go in, they need to be fired. And they should be fired today because they sat there. There's about 10 of them sat there with their blankets and the fire pits and all that, you know, and their winter jackets on and taught remotely outside. And they should be fired because that was the deal, right? That's what they told us. And Alderman 32 aldermen signed a letter to Lightfoot and CEO Janice Jackson saying it's not safe. And listen to this, Alderman. Rosanna Rodriguez Sanchez, 33rd Ward.
And we cannot guarantee that we're going to be able to protect people inside of those buildings. There is no guarantee that we are going to be able to prevent a death from happening. What are we going to do? What are we going to do if that happens?
There's an inherent risk when you walk outside your door every day. I mean, prevent a death? Are these people, has everybody lost their mind? Is anybody exercising common sense anymore?
So again, of the 226 individuals under the age of 20 who died in Chicago from March to December of last year, the end of December of last year, 109, I believe it was, died as a result of a homicide. Mm-hmm. Five, COVID. So kids shouldn't go to school either because they're outside and they could be in gang areas in Chicago, and they could get killed in crossfire, as has happened, and happened more frequently than kids dying of COVID. It's a great argument that the elder woman makes to keep kids inside permanently and forever where they're safe. On the issue of transmission, I mean, just to reset here, we say the science is, there's a basically scientific consensus on it, but I mean, let me just give you some chapter and verse on this. From the Sky News, and this has been, these are, you know, spread over the course of months. This is from early November of last year. Children do not increase the COVID risk to adults they live with, putting to rest one of the fears about keeping schools open, new research shows. An analysis of health records of 9 million working-age adults shows that those with school-aged children were no more likely than adults without children to be admitted to a hospital or to die. Adults living with primary school-aged children were not even more likely to be infected, according to this study of electronic records in England. Professor Liam Smith, one of the researchers and a clinical epidemiologist at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, said, if we can keep schools open, it's really important. It's a really important thing for this generation of young people, but we have to look at the possible risk. The take-home message is there is no evidence of harmful effect of living with kids of school age.
But here's the thing. And then,
National Geographic.
Yes.
Kids catch and spread coronavirus half as much as adults, Iceland study confirms. Nature magazine. And so just, you know, right wing and some op-ed columnists. No. Nature magazine. Data gathered worldwide are increasingly suggesting that schools are not hotspots for coronavirus infections. Despite fears, COVID-19 infections did not surge when schools and daycare centers reopened after pandemic lockdowns eased. Mm-hmm. And when outbreaks do occur, they mostly result in only a small number of people becoming ill. Again, this is one of those things, like we were discussing with lockdowns generally, now lockdown schools specifically, the lockdown of schools specifically. The models say this. The real-world studies say something else. Well, the models are the trade of the expert. So if the real-world studies say something else, if the models are not reflective of reality, then you know what we need to do. We need to fix the human beings so they comport with the models, or we need to kill them trying to do so. That's a risk they're willing to take. They're willing to take the risk of making you ill or killing you to comport to their models they're not willing to take the risk of you making decisions about how much risk you want to take on in living your life. And isn't that interesting?
And as parents, we just want a choice. You know, there's two kids on my street, Dan, who can go back to school February 11th. That's when K through 8 go back. And they're not going back. And I said, why? So I'm so afraid. I said, well, you don't have any comorbidities. You're going to be fine. And parents are letting their kids stay home. And I know that's a choice, too. But we're not going to have men in our future and strong women in our future if they don't socialize with other kids and learn how to communicate and grow and build character. This is really concerning because my son, one of them, his world history teacher asked, you know, she said yesterday during the Zoom, you know, teaching, I don't want to go back. I'm scared. And I want to know how many of you want to go back to school. And 14 said yes. 14 said no, and only 6 said yes, that they felt comfortable going back to school. If that's not even going to happen with high schoolers at CPS. But if there was a choice, that's what they said. And that's frightening, that we have scared our children into submission, that they're going to hide in their homes and in their basements or in their bedrooms for what, the rest of their lives?
European Center for Disease Prevention and Control. It's an agency of the EU. General consensus, the decision to close schools to control pandemic should be used as a last resort. I mean, this is this is about as aggressive as you're ever going to get from some, you know, global health agency. The negative physical, mental health, and educational impact of proactive school closures on children, as well as the economic impact on society more broadly, would likely outweigh the benefits. That is basically an F lockdowns statement, considering the source. Children between 1 and 18 have lower rates of hospitalization, severe hospitalization, than do all other age groups. Children of all ages, younger children appear to be less susceptible to infection when infected, and less often lead to onward transmission than older children and adults, so on and so forth.
And the 5 who've died from COVID in Chicago had severe comorbidities. And they didn't get it at school, they got it at home. Because most of the kids that are getting it home because they're not at school. And they're safer at school, studies have showed, than they are in their house, where transmission is high. Wrap your head around that one, parents. Wake up, dummies.
It's
mind-blowing to me.
This is why I say you have to decide, you know, where to spend your time, and you're going to have to, you know, release some people. You're going to have to cut them loose. And those people wearing masks outside, those people wearing masks while jogging or in their car alone, they're gone. They're not in that place based on reason, and so you're not going to be able to get them to a place of sanity through reason. It's just going to have to be, I don't know. I don't know what it will take. I don't know.
Real quickly.
A pronouncement from Tony Fauci, apparently.
Yeah, we made the mistake of going to the communist state of Hawaii. In between bites, the general manager, I'm out with Peyton. Nobody's around us. Eating outside, nobody is near us, Dan, except for this general manager of a hotel. And he told me to put up my mask in between bites of my food.
Yeah, well, that's
I couldn't get
Gavin
out of there fast enough, honest to God.
That's what Gavin Newsom suggested right before he was seen at the French Laundry. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They don't even know what's going on, like how the rest of the country's living. Like, people don't live like this, do you understand?
They do in California.
And they do in Hawaii. Don't go to that communist state.
They do in a lot of places. They do in Chicago in large measure. Laura in Rolling Meadows.
Hi, this is Laura from District 214.
Oh, hi, Laura.
Good morning. So the post yesterday with Katie Osgood and her friends and their, you know, biohazard suits cleaning the CPS classroom.
Which have been cleaned already 1,000 times.
Okay, well, besides that, no one's been in there for 9 months.
Right.
Why does it even need to be cleaned at all?
Because it's just all theatrics. It was all bull jive to scare parents and kids.
Absolutely. And I think there's a combination of a few things going on. One, clearly CTU is using the scenario for theatrics. But I read all kinds of posts on my social media from just random citizens. These people are truly believe this, that they are going to die mm-hmm. if they are exposed in any way, shape, or form with COVID. I mean, the brainwashing is complete with these people. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how we undo it.
Thanks for the call, Laura. I don't know either.
I don't either. It's going to take decades to undo this crap.
If you don't have people in your life that can snap you out of it, you know, people that you trust, you rely on, family right. members, friends, if you don't have people that can intercede with reason and evidence and tell you things like, well, and by the way, this is also other people providing examples too. The cleaning thing with the classrooms?
Yeah.
How about starting from the premise? What do we know about COVID transmission from surfaces?
That it doesn't exist.
It doesn't.
No, but
so
they
why?
Had us all
yeah, I know what they
down.
Had us all do. I know what they had us all
you
do.
You watched me do
I'm, I the whole performance art aspect mm-hmm. of this shouldn't be indulged. I don't want to be disrespectful to people. I'm not going to seek people out to excoriate them in public, be a jerk about it, but I'm not going to indulge it either. And sometimes it's not, the answer is not, it's already been cleaned. The answer is, it doesn't transmit on surfaces. Don't you know anything? Don't you pay attention? Hasn't anybody told you? Can I, or maybe even be a little bit more gentle about it than I'm inclined to be? Can I turn you on to some of the research on the topic? Can I forward something to you? Seriously, can I forward you an email? Can I give you something to look at, some information to consider? I don't know. I don't know what breaks people from this sort of psychosis. Dave in Downers Grove.
Yeah, Dan and Amy. I'm a truck driver for a food chain, a grocery chain here in Illinois for the last 20-something years. I feel that I've been risking my life for the children, the teachers, and everybody else every day. And also, I came up with an idea about a year ago. Why don't we just have, like they do on the Sunday shows, a big screen in every classroom, have one teacher broadcast live stream to each classroom with teacher's aides in there. You could have one teacher, 10 classrooms, and, you know, problem solved. They don't even have to go to school. They can broadcast from their bedroom.
Yeah, okay. Thanks for the call, Dave, although that's not necessarily the best arrangement for the kids.
No.
And by the way, just again, a point of order on teachers. I think the median age of a teacher in the United States is 42 years old. And the survival rate of people under the age of 50 who are infected with COVID is like 99.98%.
Yeah.
So 999 out of 1,000 survive. That's an unacceptable risk. George in Libertyville.
Hey, good morning, guys. I mean, this is absolutely incredible. And, you know, how about like 3 weeks ago, after screaming for a year, we need a vaccine. Literally within 24 hours, the vaccine was being announced, it's being delivered. Then immediately there is a new strain now that we need to be worried about. It's you know, like you guys said.
Super COVID.
You know, should just walk
around. Now there's a South African strain, too, a third one.
Yeah, it'll never. Like you said, it's sad. It'll never end with some of these people, most of them.
And in point Take of care. Fact, something that Bojo said yesterday in announcing his latest lockdown is incorrect. One, you expect mutations from viruses. Two, there is no belief at this point, although it's very early in the identification of these mutations, that they will be vaccine resistant, or that they're. I even dispute that we know that they're necessarily more contagious.
Yeah, we don't
like
know.
A higher R-naught number, or that they'll be more lethal than COVID-19. These are just suppositions that are being made for the purposes of providing a basis, not a legitimate one, but a basis for the same policies that have been pursued for the last 10 months. And I would say not only to no great effect, but policies where the costs have vastly outweighed the benefits. Lives versus lives. That's the measure I'm referring to. Greg in LaGrange.
Hi, good morning. I can't believe that one teacher that you had on talking about deaths, what happens if there's a death? There's death all around you. Look at all the shootings. Look at all the shootings in the city. There's no outcry about that at all. But they're worried about something that is statistically insignificant. It happens. There's risk in life. But they run around with chickens, like chickens with their heads cut off. And the thing that really bothers me is, it wouldn't bother me if you were coming after me because I'm older. They're destroying kids, right? Teachers are there to teach children how to learn. They're there to teach children how to think, how to reason, and how to learn to love to learn, and how to appreciate what it is to pick up a book and read. And they're destroying all of it. They're destroying all of it. And what's the answer? We need more money. We need more of this. We need more of that. They can't even impart the basics of education on children. Amy, there are no men left. Okay, don't worry about that. The problem I have right now is that this has been so deeply rooted in people's psyche. I'm like Scott Shelley. I think it's going to take years, a decade, to get people to unwind from this because that's how afraid people are.
They're brainwashed.
Thanks for the call.
I mean, it really is frightening.
I think it's a longer tale than that. It may be a decade just for the kids and the trauma that they suffer. This is according to some child psychologists that we've spoken to. But I think this is going to be sort of the new protocol among a wide swath of the population for the next virus, whenever that may come.
God.
But we know it will come. This is a cultural reset, if you will.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy yesterday at the Dalton, Georgia rally. Mike Pence spoke before President Trump spoke. And obviously the focus was on the two Senate races up today, but there was time to talk a little bit about Wednesday as well, and Pence had this to say.
You know, I know we all got our doubts about the last election. And I want to assure you, I share the concerns of millions of Americans about voting irregularities. And I promise you, come this Wednesday, we'll have our day in Congress. We'll hear the objections. We'll hear the evidence. But tomorrow is Georgia's day.
And President Trump built upon that to sort of make a reference to his vice president.
And I hope Mike Pence comes through for us. I hope that our great vice president comes through for us. He's a great guy. Of course, if he doesn't come through, I won't like him quite as much. Now, Mike is a great guy. He's a wonderful man and a smart man and a man that I like a lot. But he's going to have, you're going to get straight shots. He's going to call it straight.
Well, if he calls it straight, then he's going to serve largely in a ceremonial role of counting the electors, presiding over the counting of the electors that have been submitted by the 50 states. So I don't know what the president's expectation is. He didn't really develop that. So we'll have to see. Josh Hawley, the first Republican senator to announce publicly that he would be lodging an objection tomorrow, was on with our friend Brett Baer yesterday. And he sort of articulated the same thing he did on Fox last week about the responsibility he feels he owes his constituents to provide voice for their concerns, much like Mike Pence was referencing. And Brett Baer pressed him if he doesn't also owe his constituents some honesty about what's going to happen on January 20th in terms of the next president of the United States.
That we have a vote of certification and that we have the opportunity to debate the results, to certify the results, we count them, and then we certify. And my point is, this is my only opportunity during this process to raise an objection and to be heard. I don't have standing to file lawsuits. I'm not a prosecutor anymore. I used to be, but I'm not anymore. I can't investigate claims of voter fraud on my own, but I do have a responsibility in this joint session of Congress to either say I've got no problem with it or I do have a problem with it. And my constituents expect
me,
and they're right, to say I have a problem.
To your constituents. Don't you have a responsibility to tell them that it's not going to be President Trump as of January 21st as well?
Well, Brett, I'm trying to do something more than just that. I mean, this is about the integrity of our elections. And this is about taking a stand where you can take a stand. I mean, I suppose you can just say, well, listen, nothing I do will matter. It won't matter if I object or not, so I'll just sit by and do nothing. I mean, that's one approach, but I can tell you that the people of my state, they won't understand that, and they shouldn't. They say you have the opportunity to stand up and be heard and to object. You have the opportunity to try and force change, and you should, and that's what.
For more on this, we're pleased to be joined again by Andy McCarthy, former chief assistant U.S. attorney in Manhattan, contributing editor at National Review, author of the bestseller Ball of Collusion, The Plot to Rig an Election and Destroy a Presidency. Andy, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. Good morning.
Good morning. I've read your commentary on the topic, so I have a pretty good idea where you're coming from. And you suggest, and you particularly focus in on Cruz and Hawley because they're both fairly respected originalist officers of the court. And you suggest that what they're doing is improper. It shouldn't be done.
Yeah, well, it is improper, and they know it's improper. Especially after you played what you just played, the
Hawley
session that Hawley had, where he really wouldn't answer Brett Baer's pointed question. I've really come around to the idea, Dan, that this is just—it's not just a cynical exercise in trying to appeal to Trump's base. I think that the Electoral Commission is a con job. And that is, if you notice when Hawley was answering or not answering Baer's questions, he wouldn't say what he was going to object to. He just kept saying, I'm going to object. This is my only opportunity to stand up and object. But notice what he didn't say, which is what Wednesday is about. He didn't say, I'm going to object to Pennsylvania's votes. I'm going to object to Wisconsin's votes. And I think what these guys have done is they don't want to be in a position of making the Republican Party against the enfranchisement or having the Republican Party disenfranchise the voters in states that Republicans are going to need in the future to win elections if they ever want to win the presidency again. That's not a position they want to be in. So I think they've come up with this Electoral Commission as something that they know will lose, but that they can call for, and that will be their objection. So,
What will happen is
they won't object to any particular state, which will mean if that happens, that'll mean the House, they can make as much noise as they want. If they don't get a senator who goes along with them, then no state's votes are going to be objected to, and they'll just pretend that this Electoral Commission is the the be all and end all of their objection. And of course, that thing's going to go down in flames because it's not going to have enough votes. And then, we'll all be able to get on with our lives. I can hope at least that that's what is going on.
Well, let me respond in two ways to that. One is I agree that they're doing this recognizing that it's not going to happen, that they're doing this as a way to put a marker down. Now, in the conversation that Hawley had with Baer and McCallum, they did talk about Pennsylvania specifically and Pennsylvania Supreme Court's action and inaction specifically. So that may be part of it. Now, remember, Hawley is not part of the Election Commission, just to restate there. Cruz and 11 others. Hawley really focused on – so he sort of talked generally about election irregularities, and then he focused, and I think this will be the thrust of probably his comments since this is the thrust of his rise to prominence, focusing on social media, the big tech companies. But as you know, with 2 hours to debate each of the states that are raised, and you have to raise them in writing, specific states, you know that there are going to be some senators and members of the House that are in safe districts or safe states, as the case may be, that will go specifically after Pennsylvania and the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, will go after indefinitely confined designees in Wisconsin and some of the other states. And it is interesting to note that among those, and I noted this yesterday, among those Republican senators who've signed on to object, Ron Johnson seems to be the only one in a state that is really, you know, up for grabs, where he is really taking a political risk in signing on to this.
Yeah, I want to be clear. All the things that you just went through, you know, there are a number of aspects of Pennsylvania's election that are objectionable, not least the illegal extension of the 3 days on Election Day. There's probably three or four that we could go through, but that's the main one that's been before the Supreme Court since October, and the court won't act on it. I wrote a column that kind of analyzed what the state Supreme Court in Wisconsin did and came to the conclusion that at least one big category of the votes they were talking about, which is these Democracy in the Park events where they didn't actually give ballots to state election officials, which is what state law requires. I think those 17,000 votes should have been thrown out, but that doesn't mean they were 17,000 votes for Biden. You know, and right. Even if they were 3-1 or 4-1 for Biden, it's still not enough to get over the, you know, to get over the 22,000 or whatever it is that he lost by. So what I'm saying is there's a number of things to object to. And, you know, while I've tried to be realistic about how this is coming out, I've tried to point out what I think each one of them is. But here's the thing that you also, if you're going to be persnickety about that, and I have been, and I can understand why others should be, because this is an important issue going forward, regardless of what happens with Trump. But the other thing, if you're going to follow the law, then you got to follow the law. Under Section 5 of the federal election law, if the states certify by 6 days before the electoral votes are counted, as a matter of federal law, that is dispositive. So they don't, you know, it says in federal law that, you know, if this is resolved at the state level, because under the Constitution, the states are sovereign when it comes to picking the president. It's not even the people, it's the states. If the states have resolved this, Josh Hawley has to respect that because he's a federal official and federal law says that we respect the state certification at that point. So should we object to these things? Should we address them for future purposes? Absolutely. And if they were to have an electoral commission, not for the purpose of delegitimizing the current election, but for curing the problems going forward, and even though I've always been someone who's been opposed to this, imposing some federal rules on what states are allowed to do and not allowed to do if we're going to go down this crazy path of doing mail-in voting, fine. I think that's all to the good to do that. But I just think if this thing is going to be a debacle about delegitimizing the election we had, where people like Josh Hawley, a Supreme Court clerk who graduated from Yale Law School and well knows he can read a statute just like I can, under federal law, what has already happened is dispositive. And
yeah,
his role on Wednesday is to watch the votes get counted.
Although the Election Count Act of 1887 does provide an opportunity to object, right?
It's the law says. I happen to think this part of the law is unconstitutional, but the law
right,
does
but,
say.
But the law is the law at
senator,
present.
Well, okay, but then I don't ever want to hear if everybody wants to take that position, fine. But then don't come back and tell me that you're really offended that the deep state and the swamp wants to federalize our elections, because that's precisely what you're doing. If you're taking the position that Congress can second states on their elections to dispose of their electoral votes, that's a longtime Democratic position. So let's not pretend that, you know, we're all, you know, limited government conservatives, because we're not.
Well, then why are Hawley and Cruz doing this? I mean, they're smart people. As you mentioned, they're both former Supreme Court clerks. But what's the motive? If they know
they want to run for president, they want to appeal to the Trump. There's 75 million people voted for Trump.
or 74 million, whatever it is, that's a pretty good start for an election campaign. If you can, you know, if you can get his core part of that, I don't know, you know, look, I consider myself a kind of traditional National Review type conservative who voted more against Biden than for Trump, although I think Trump did a lot of good things policy-wise. But of that 75 million people, you know, somewhere between 25 and 45 are pretty hardcore Trump people. And if you could command that base, that is, command the loyalty of that base, that's a pretty good start to an election campaign.
Yeah, there's no question. And something you said, look, I think you make an important point, not just about the safe harbor provision in federal law, but about, you know, remember, let's remember way back 4 weeks ago when we were in five lifetimes ago, 4 weeks ago, before December 8th and before December 14th. And we talked about in this show, you know, you're on clocks here because we were talking about all the litigation that was being filed. We were assessing the legal strategy and so forth. You're on a December 8th clock. We talked about this with you. We're on a December 8th clock. We're on a December 14th clock. And as you go through that process, you know, your options winnow. And so that's exactly what's happened. And I think, and I know you understand this, but I want to give voice to it because I don't want to be dismissive of the exasperation the way that some are, not talking about you, which is to say, right, we have these arenas for dispute resolution. And you know what? They failed us. That's what people are saying. They failed us. The Pennsylvania Supreme Court failed us, and then the United States Supreme Court failed us. And we've had and maybe the Trump legal team failed us too, but they raised real issues that should have been investigated further. So we got substantive answers to some of the concerns or some of the irregularities, some of the wild statistical anomalies. And we're left unsatisfied because we don't have good answers there. And there's probably blame to spread around at least some of, if not all of, and more, the categories I mentioned. And I just and I find the whole thing unsatisfying. And so I'm sort of the position, knowing that the Democrats are ends justify the means types, that we should start playing by their rules, which is to say no rules, to try to get some justice here.
Well, let me just say about that, because I think there's a lot of force to what you just said. But the problem with this whole escapade since November 3rd has been that we look at the election as if the election was the only thing going on, and because it's a complex problem. The only way you can deal with complex problems is to kind of sort of focus in on them at the expense of everything else. But life doesn't work that way. There's a number of different interests involved, and one of the important interests is you have to have a president who's up and running and ready to go on January 20th, which requires some preparation. And it used to be the law in our country until the Constitution was changed that the president didn't get inaugurated until, was it March? I forget.
March.
If it was March 20th or March 4th, but it was March, right? So if you had that system again, you would be able to focus more. You'd have more time, and you'd be able to focus more on the election. You wouldn't be trying to prove fraud on a compressed time frame, which is a very, very difficult thing to do unless there's some screaming evidence of fraud. But the reason that the Constitution got changed is we found that that was a terrible way to run the government, to have a lame duck president for, you know, 6 months or whatever it was. And that was the reason it got moved back. And the reason I bring that up is there simply is no perfect solution here. You know, we can decide after this experience that we need to focus like a laser beam on nothing but the election. And what we'll be doing is disserving the preparation for the next president to be up and running and ready to go at noon on Inauguration Day. And I just think it's very easy to miss that now because this has been so controversial. But the fact is there are other concerns here. And the most important concern to the United States is that somebody is ready to be president at noon on January 20th.
He is Andy McCarthy, former chief assistant U.S. attorney in Manhattan, contributing editor of National Review, author of the bestseller Ball of Collusion, The Plot to Rig an Election and Destroy a Presidency. Andy, always appreciate your time. Thank you.
You guys have a great day. Thanks.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.proanswer line.
You're listening to Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, and Save America rally tomorrow. That's Wednesday, January 6th. Doors open at 7 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. At 1 o'clock, the protest begins in earnest at the U.S. Capitol. This is the rally that Trump has indicated he may stop by, may pay a visit to. Wouldn't that be interesting?
Yeah, here in Illinois or in Chicago, 9 a.m. to 3 p.m., at Lakeview High School at the corner of Ashland and Irving Park Road. They're going to be a rally all day there.
And so you know, President Trump yesterday at the rally in Dalton, Georgia for Perdue and Loeffler opened the show by talking about himself and his electoral prospects.
Your vote tomorrow could lose, and it could be your last chance to save the America that we love. That's why I'm here. I don't want to do rallies for other people. I told you. I'm here because of that, because of David and Kelly. The far left wants to destroy our country, demolish our history, and erase everything that we hold dear. This could be the most important vote you will ever cast for the rest of your life. It really could be.
Big statement in addition
coming
to
up next.
His,
it's me, Mike.
In addition to Mike Gallagher chiming in for some reason, in addition to his saying that he didn't lose, he's won both the elections he's run in. Somebody who is going to be at that rally tomorrow. He is a Georgian, and he is C.J. Pearson. You may remember C.J., who rose to some prominence a few years ago when he took to the interweb that the kids like so much and offered some pointed and rather entertaining criticism of one President Obama as a young man. I think CJ started getting involved in politics when he was still in utero because he's still a very young man. He's also the president of the Free Thinker Project and host of the podcast CJ Pearson Uncensored. CJ, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Dan and Amy. It's always a pleasure to be with you guys.
So are you the reason the National Guard has been scrambled for tomorrow?
You know, that's what they're telling me. But I've got to tell you, you know, every time that the left is scared of people who love America. It's why they're reacting in the way that they are. We've seen the mayor of D.C. react in the most outlandish way to the fact that people are coming to D.C. in protest and in support of something simple such as election integrity. She's closed restaurants. She's limited access to things like restrooms. Like, she has gone all out to ensure that this protest doesn't happen. But what she does not realize is that she cannot quell the energy and enthusiasm that powers and drives this movement. People are just genuinely angry. They're mad at the fact that the left is trying intentionally or overtly to steal this election from the American people. They're not even trying to hide it at this point. And people will come. People will come regardless of the efforts by Mayor Bowser, because we are fighting for America. And as the president said last night in his speech in Dalton, Georgia, is that we will hold the line, and we're committed to doing all that we can in that fight to do so.
And as a native Georgian, give us your handle on those two Senate races.
You know, those two Senate races are incredibly important. You know, both Senator Loeffler and Perdue have stood by the president time and again. They've been great advocates for the conservative agenda throughout their time in the Senate. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to their alternatives, John Ossoff and Reverend Raphael Warnock, they're not Georgia. These are far-left liberals made in the mold of folks like AOC and Nancy Pelosi. When people say, "Win Georgia, save America," that's not just a talking point. That's reality. If those two individuals are elected to the U.S. Senate, we're going to see things like court packing. We're going to see things like crazy tax hikes. We're going to see things like open borders. Everything that President Trump has worked to advance for the past 4 years will be undone due to the fact that they will declare an all-out assault upon the values on which America was built. That's what we're fighting against in Georgia, and why we're working so hard to keep this set up.
What's your take, though? I mean, I know you're still a young guy, but something's maybe it is being driven by the young in part. I don't know. What's your take on how it is that two individuals as far left and, frankly, particularly with respect to Warnock, as disagreeable as those two are, and Ossoff, who's this pajamas boy, I mean, that doesn't exactly fit with Georgia culture, how they could be in a position to be U.S. senators? It's just shocking what's happened in Georgia.
Well, let me tell you, it's not Georgians voting for these people. It's people who come to our state from far left states like California, Oregon, and so many more places, fleeing the excessive taxes and assault on freedom that they have from their home state. And they come, but they vote the same way in Georgia. You know, it's something that is mind-boggling to me. You know, you escape the tyranny of the state you left only to vote for the same policies that got you to the place you were. Once you get to this new state, you know, it's absurd. But what I will say is that I do believe that Georgia's values will win the day today. There's been a lot of enthusiasm on both sides of this, but I think that we will, you know, leave it all on the field today. We have a lot of votes left to be received. You know, typically GOP voters are election day voters, and we love to see that. And so, you know, if we drive turnout today, we'll come out on top, and I'm confident that we can do that. We just got to turn out our voters.
Well, 3 million people voted early. And I feel like your election has been going for a month now where people could do in-person voting. But considering what happened in the general election, you know, with the suitcases of ballots and then people voting twice, do you believe in the integrity of this election?
You know, I'm hoping for the best. You know, what I would have loved to see is from our governor, Kemp, has declared a special session to ensure that we could have implemented the protections that a lot of people have been calling for that would have guaranteed the integrity of this election. But what I hope to see from this is that with the heightened attention that is going to be on this election, there are going to be more observers, and a lot of the things that were allowed to happen in the November election won't be allowed to happen this time. Brad Raffensperger knows that we're watching him. A lot of these local officials who prevented GOP observers from watching the counting of ballots and who oversaw the non-counting of certain ballots in certain counties and certain here in the state, we saw thousands of votes not be counted that they just randomly found during a manual recount. I didn't know that happened in America. It sounded more like Venezuela to me, but you know, I think that the heightened attention of this race will definitely, hopefully, alleviate a lot of shenanigans that we saw in the November election, for sure.
For our listeners who don't know you, you're a young black man, and I wonder what you think, regardless of what happens in Georgia, regardless of what happens with the presidential contest, you know, thinking prospectively, as young people should, as we all should, what do you think is there? What do you think exists in terms of a foundation upon which to build in the Republican Party doing a better job of appealing to and securing the support of young black men and young black women in America?
You know, let me be fundamentally clear about, you know, where we are as a country right now. You know, we are in a fundamental fight for our values that our nation was built upon. And because the left has declared an all-out assault upon those values. They've declared an assault on things like law and order, rule of law, our capitalist economic system. And they will do whatever it takes to get rid of those things. And when it comes to young black voters and minority voters in general, let's just also be clear about that. The Democrat Party, for time and time again, only seems to care about black people during an election year. They don't talk about black issues any other time. And when they get elected, they neglect black people throughout the entirety of their tenure. And I think what we're about to see in the coming years is that black people are going to say that we are tired of being used and abused by a party that doesn't care about us. Used and abused by the party that is the founder of the KKK, the party that pushed segregation, that pushed things like Jim Crow laws, all of those things that historically set black people back. That was the party that originated with. And they're still doing the same thing, just in a different way. And so what I think we'll see in the years to come is a community of black folks who are just like, we
deserve more. We demand better. And where have they been getting better? It's the GOP. The party that the media loves to call racist and fundamentally bigoted is the party that has brought about the lowest black unemployment rate in our nation's history, that reformed our criminal justice system, that poured millions of dollars into HBCUs, created economic opportunity zones, which poured commercial investment into inner cities that have long been misgoverned by Democrat politicians. It was Republicans that did that. The big racist, bad wolf. It was Republicans that did that, not Democrats. And I think that's on the mind of a lot of minority voters these days. And it's why President Trump had a record amount of black support in his past election that apparently he didn't win, according to CNN and MSNBC. But,
well, yeah. So tomorrow, are there any particular festivities that you're participating in, anything going on that you're looking forward to?
Yeah, so I'm excited to be at a lot of the events. So today, actually Tuesday, it all kicks off today. I'll actually be in just an hour. I'll be headed to D.C. myself at starting at 1 p.m. We'll all be at Freedom Plaza up until, I think, 6 p.m. or so. And then in tomorrow is the big day. You know, starting at 7 a.m., people will be allowed to start walking in to the President's Park, which is called the Eclipse. And where there's going to be a huge rally there where the president will speak. He'll address the crowd at 11 a.m. We'll then walk to the Capitol where Congress will be voting whether or not to certify the Electoral College results. And then from there, we're just going to keep the pressure, keep the enthusiasm, keep the energy in the city. And what's fundamental about that, and what's so important about that, is that everyone in Congress should know that we are watching them, that we will not allow this country to be stolen away from the American people and the will of the people to be disregarded and neglected. Because if we allow the left to steal this election, they will just do it again and again. They'll do it this cycle, they'll do it next cycle, they'll do it because we let them get away with it. But we're not going to let them get away with it. And that's why it's so incredibly exciting to see the enthusiasm that has happened because of the Stop the Steal movement, and see the fact that hundreds of thousands of people will be in D.C. This week is just, it's incredible.
He is C.J. Pearson, president of the Free Thinker Project, host of the podcast C.J. Pearson Uncensored. C.J., thanks for joining us. Have fun both in D.C. and Georgia.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you, and he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Dan and Amy are talking about it. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. In his 1841 book, Extraordinary Popular Delusions and the Madness of Crowds, Scottish journalist Charles Mackay observed that men go mad in herds while they only recover their senses slowly and one by one. I think that's right. I think there's a lot of psychologists who will tell you that's right, and those at least with some experience of dealing with folie du situations. I think of sort of the Branch Davidians or some other cult on a smaller level. So only recover their senses slowly and one by one. That is probably not going to be led on an individualized basis by a lot of politicians, heads of state in particular, as we saw from Bojo yesterday afternoon, Boris Johnson announcing a renewed lockdown in the UK through the middle of February.
You may only leave home for limited reasons permitted in law, such as to shop for essentials, to work if you absolutely cannot work from home, to exercise, to seek medical assistance.
And it's a combination of things, perhaps, or certainly a combination of variables to consider. One is the incentives that are presented to politicians, as we've seen play out so far, at least. There is no consequence to overreaching on lockdowns, overreaching on regulation of people's personal conduct. And so the incentives are to err on that side. And it turns out not only are there no negative consequences, there's all sorts of political and potentially financial, Andrew Cuomo, benefits to doing so. If you engender enough fear, if you have a big enough herd that you've facilitated madness within, It seems to me that's where we're at. And so for those who are thinking, as we were discussing a little bit earlier on the show, that at some point there's sort of going to be this mass awakening. People wake up, you know, that sort of plaintive wail. Right. People wake up, and there's going to be – it's going to spread like a brush fire through the population, the people that are jogging with masks on and so forth. I don't think so. And I'm not talking about like between now and when we reach herd immunity through the combination of vaccine and infection. I mean for generation or maybe generations to come. That's my view. Let's talk to another journalist who's become an expert in this space because he's
kind of the
journalist.
Cat's meow, yeah, when it comes to COVID.
But the reason he's become an expert is because he's a good journalist. Mm-hmm. And I make that distinction, speaking of Charles McKay, the Scottish journalist here who wrote this magnum opus, really, it's still relevant almost 200 years later, 180 years later, is because he's intellectually curious and he does what this so-called journalists of the D.C. press corps, today at least, don't do. He doesn't pretend to be omniscient. The funniest thing of all, some of these thinly educated or overeducated but thinly credentialed in terms of capacity to problem solve run around behaving like they're omniscient, that you know that they've gone to the Tony Fauci Public Affairs School of Epidemiology, so now they can converse on the topic with the same depth that any other medical professional, public health professional has on the topic, and thus they can dismiss questions from laymen like us in the body politic. It would be comical if the implications weren't so serious. Of course, I'm talking about Alex Berenson, former New York Times reporter and author of the number one bestseller, Unreported Truths About COVID-19 and Lockdowns, combined parts 1 through 3, Death Counts, Lockdowns, and Masks, which you can get at Amazon. You can get it at Amazon because he pitched a fit over Amazon, delisting him from Amazon, mm-hmm. and they relented, and good for him. Alex Berenson, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Of course, of course.
I just want to get your reaction to, you know, when are people going to wake up, you know, from people who are trying to be measured, try to be thoughtful about this, maybe even are a little bit more dogmatic in opposing lockdowns. When are people going to wake up? And my answer is, there a lot of them are not.
I mean, I'm actually a tiny bit more optimistic than you are today. I'm not sure that's been true in the past, and there's a couple reasons for that. I mean, I'm not more optimistic about the media, by the way, but I'm more optimistic about average folks. Look, we are not seeing a move by the state governors in places like Illinois and New York to impose hard lockdowns again. And I think that's because they're looking at their finances and knowing that they can't. That even if the Democrats win in the Senate, maybe they'll get a few months of bailout. But what's happening to the, you know, to people leaving New York for Florida or Illinois for Florida and Texas or California for Texas is catastrophic on the high end. You know, these high end wage earners who account for so much of state tax collections that these states, I mean, they're incredibly expensive to run, and they can't afford to keep driving those people away. And those people are leaving. Okay, they are leaving. And what we're seeing with the vaccine is incredible. The fact that healthcare workers, the people who are supposed to want this the most, okay, are rejecting it. Not all of them, but that a significant minority of them are rejecting the vaccine is incredible. The vaccine, people are voting now. They have a chance to vote on something, right? They couldn't vote on lockdowns. They couldn't vote on the mask mandates because if you want to go shopping, you have to wear a mask. But you can vote, essentially, on whether you're going to get a vaccine. Now the public health establishment may try to change that. They may try to mandate vaccines, and that will be a big mistake and a big fight if it happens. Right now, it's not mandatory, and people are saying no. They're saying, I think the dangers of the vaccine and the unknowns about the vaccine are worse than COVID. And that's an incredible thing to see because it tells me that people under 75, under 80, have a real understanding of what the risks are to them and how low they are. And they don't want to take a chance on a vaccine. Then maybe I'll say the correct age to set that at is 65, but it's not 40, it's not 50, okay? We know the vaccines can have severe side effects to people who receive them. And we know COVID isn't that dangerous to healthy people under, and when I say not that dangerous, I mean really not that dangerous to healthy people under 40 and even 50. So people, whether or not they know the numbers, they have some idea of this at this point. And more people, I think, are just living their lives right now as best they can. And they're putting on a mask, and they may think the mask helps them, or they may think they just have to wear it, but they're going on. It's actually, and so now you're seeing in places like New York and Chicago, they're trying to get the schools open because they know they have to do that. It's the media that's dragging its feet at this point. I think I'd like to be more optimistic than you.
Well,
are
our
today.
Teachers union in Chicago is not letting people go back to work because they don't want to go back to work because they don't think it's safe.
You can go to Puerto Rico, right? But you can't go to work.
Right, exactly. I'm too afraid to teach, but I'm not too afraid to travel. What are some of the adverse effects that you're seeing from the vaccine in your investigations here?
So it's not my investigation. This is the thing. Like, this data is all publicly available. Okay, it's very widely available. You just have to look for it. So the two companies that ran, you know, that have vaccines distributed right now, these are called mRNA vaccines. They work in a way that no other vaccine does, which doesn't necessarily make them dangerous, but it does mean that, you know, you'd like to have some long-term safety data before you encourage billions of people around the world to get them, and we don't have that data. So what happens with these vaccines is they stimulate a pretty strong short-term response in the body, and especially after the second dose. So one person in five will have what's called of the Moderna vaccine, which seems to be more problematic. One person in five who receives the Moderna vaccine at the second dose will have a pretty high fever, or chills and nausea and shaking, or vomiting, essentially severe fatigue, stuff that is probably for most people going to be worse than COVID would be. And again, that's not true if you're 85, but if you're if you're a healthy adult, it looks like the vaccine causes more what virologists call reactogenicity than COVID does. Okay, so. And these trials covered thousands and thousands of people. They covered the Moderna trial covered about 30,000 people, and the Pfizer trial covered about 40,000. So these events were not infrequent. And it looks like in the real world, the safety profile is at least as bad as it was in the clinical trials. Now, this is not to say, most of these people are going to get better after a couple of days, but a fair number of them wind up in an ER. Some of them wind up hospitalized. We don't know if any of them die. In the clinical trials, there were no deaths related to the vaccines. But there were also no deaths. There was only one death, by the way, in both clinical trials in people who didn't receive the vaccine, who received only a placebo from COVID. So, and that again, is with a huge number of people. And that just tells you COVID isn't all that dangerous to people who are in pretty good medical condition. Let me say one more thing about the vaccines, because I know you have other questions. What the company should have been forced to do was give the vaccine, a lot of doses of the vaccine, to people who are older and sick, because those are people who die from COVID. We should have had thousands and thousands of people over 75 and even 85 who'd gotten the vaccine in clinical trials. Then we'd know if the vaccine worked in those people who are the people we really want to take it. But they weren't forced to do that. And they probably weren't forced to do that, A, because it would have been harder and more complicated to enroll those people. But also, some of those people would have died, because older people do die, right? Unfortunately, fairly regularly, whether they get COVID, whether they get a vaccine or not. And that might have made the vaccine look worse. And there clearly was pressure to get this thing out.
Well, yeah, right. And it made the vaccine look worse, as opposed to being able to say 95% safe and effective. In addition, and frankly, remember, they're coming from a place that they've been encouraged to come from by the political media establishment, which is to say everybody's equally vulnerable.
That's right. That's sort of the original sin of all of this, saying everybody's equally vulnerable when that's not true by a factor of 1,000 or so. And let's be clear, the vaccine does seem to prevent the transmission of COVID. Like, it looks good in that way. It looks effective. The question is really on the safety side, not the effectiveness side.
And I wanted to just emphasize this point about the vaccine, because, I recently watched the podcast you did with Joe Rogan, which is excellent. I encourage people. I wish I had 3 hours with you like he did. It was really good, although you do have a bit of a potty mouth. I don't know if I should blame Rogan for that or that's
put
just you coming.
Rogan,
you heard him baiting me, didn't you?
He did bait you a little bit. But with respect to the vaccine, you know, you said I'm not taking it. No way are my children taking it, the mRNA vaccine. But I wanted to give you the chance to make clear it's not because you're an anti-vaxxer. It's because it's unproven and you're doing a risk assessment based on the risk that COVID infection presents.
That's correct. That's correct. And you know, listen, if a vaccine that doesn't have all these short-term adverse events comes out, I'd probably take it because, you know, I'm at low risk, but I'm at some risk. Whether or not I'd let my kids take it, I don't know, because kids are at such minuscule risk from COVID. I mean, it's almost impossible even to figure out what the risk to healthy kids is from COVID. And so it might be better just to let them get it, like getting a cold, and get over it. But for me, yeah, but my kids have been vaccinated with everything. I mean, you know, one of the sad things about this for me is it's made me realize that, you know, maybe the anti-vaxxers have a point in general, although I'm not saying they do. I'm just saying if I, you know, in another life, if I have more time, it's something I'd like to look at, because I didn't know what I didn't know about vaccines until this started. But no, I've been properly vaccinated. My kids have been vaccinated. This vaccine, but, you know, those weren't mRNA vaccines. They were just ordinary vaccines that have been in circulation for generations in most cases.
Do you get a flu shot every year?
I don't, you know, because I sort of figure I don't need it. I'm a healthy adult. But my kids they even got the flu shot this year, actually.
I wanted to get your reaction to, I thought, an interesting comparison by an economist calling COVID-19 our Vietnam, or, you know, this generation's Vietnam, the 60 generation, thinking about the millennials, essentially, or Gen Zers Vietnam. And the comparisons are manifest. One, sort of the sunk cost mentality that politicians are susceptible to. We've made such a commitment to Vietnam, we need to continue escalating. We've made such a commitment to lockdowns, we need to continue escalating or continue repurposing lockdowns. We don't have an exit strategy. This is all we know, so we're going to continue to send in troops in the form of public health professionals excoriating you for visiting your family on Christmas. The poor and the working class, the ones bearing the brunt of the cost of waging the war on COVID-19. The long tail, the generational impact this is going to have on young people, not sent off to war, but forced to hide in their homes and not socialize and be what young people are supposed to be. I just wanted to get, you know, these war metaphors that are always used by politicians. I don't think that they'll enjoy this war metaphor as well, and I usually don't. But for this one, I kind of see some of the interesting comparisons to make it concrete.
I agree. I think I tweeted back in April that I thought, you know, the only two public policy mistakes you could compare this to in the 20th century were in the U.S., Vietnam, and worldwide, World War One. I mean, you know, this is a disaster, and it's gone on and on and on. I think you're right, though. I think the Vietnam analogy makes even more sense now in the fact that it has gone on for so long, and we don't seem to have an exit strategy. And you're right. Like, why do they continue to double down? Right? It is clear now. It should be clear to everyone that the hospitals can manage this, right? They've been managing it. Now, I'm not saying that healthcare workers aren't working hard. I'm not saying they don't deserve our support. I'm not saying they don't deserve our respect, but they are doing their jobs for us, and the hospitals are running, and not just for COVID, right? People who need other care can get it. If you get in a car crash, you're going to get to the ER, you're going to get treated. If you need a bypass surgery, you're going to get it. We are functioning as a society, despite what the media wants to pretend, and despite what some, you know, political leaders want to pretend. And why can't we just acknowledge that fact and acknowledge that, yes, COVID is, you know, is dangerous to some people, and unfortunately has killed, you know, a fair number of elderly people and some, you know, some younger people. But we're going on with our lives. I don't understand why that position is considered so impossible just to say it like that.
And the emphasis you placed in your interview with Rogan that I referenced was in terms of, like, if you had to pick one, the worst public policy decision that's been made throughout the last 10 months, what would that be?
Well, that's a good question. I guess the initial lockdown. I mean, that's hard to say that because we were afraid in March, right? So, I guess I'd say in April and May, not being more honest with people, right? And not saying we're going to move forward with this. We can do this. We're not going to try to scare you about your kids. We're going to get the schools open. We're going to get back to life.
Yeah, that's where
we're going to have to live with this. I mean, I guess that's what I said.
But I mean, in terms of specific, you know, sort of the live with this is general. But you, the emphasis you placed when you were talking with Rogan was on schools.
Oh yes. I mean that absolutely. I mean, in terms of the one, yes, that's been horrible. And you know, and now we've scared all these teachers in Portland who I want to say are scared. I'd rather have them be scared than just be cynical and think that teaching at home is an easier way to get a paycheck. But we're destroying the public schools. We're destroying them. And, you know, wealthy parents, white, you know, upper middle class parents, who can get their kids out are doing it. They're leaving the public schools in even worse shape in big cities than they were. And I don't know how we fix that. I mean, you know, you have me thinking about Vietnam and the line is, you know, we should have declared victory and gone home. Right. And that's sort of what we need to do with this. But CNN won't let us, right?
No. Well, they've got a lot of helpers, too.
And, Alex, if you can, check my Twitter out. You'll see what some teachers wore to school yesterday. They had a report to work for kindergarten, preschool teachers and special ed teachers. Kids come next week, but you should check out what they wore. It's Amy Jacobson, S-O-N. You'll like it. You'll be entertained.
Amy, I will take a look. But I mean, again, what do you think? You're on the ground in Chicago. Are the teachers actually scared, or is this theater for them because it's annoying to them that they have to go back in?
This is all theater. All theater,
yeah.
Because they want other demands that they didn't get. Because they went on strike last year, so our kids have missed out on a lot of in-person learning. And so they want a new Green Deal. They want to make, you know, I mean, they want smaller class sizes, and they said they're not going to go back in until they get that.
So it's not going to happen. So, Alex, I mean, this is seems to me a key point, too. Just like the teacher strike last year in Chicago was about money, but it was really about politics, too. That's what these public school systems, particularly the big urban ones, have become. They're just incubators for political activism. So are some scared? Probably. Is some of it theater and their convenience and their opportunity to condition their work even more so? Sure. And the other is, you know what, that these are political apparatchiks in the classroom and outside the classroom. And as you know, everything about COVID-19 has been infected with politics.
Yes. So when you have a hammer, everything looks like a nail, huh? Everything looks
right.
Like a political fight.
Right. Isn't that what you've witnessed as you've covered this in detail over the last 10 months?
Yes. I mean, but as you say, I read that Chicago Tribune story today. It was a horrible story. I mean, there wasn't one quote from a parent saying, "I'm glad my kids are going back." I mean, it basically could have been written by the teachers' union for the press release.
Right.
And that's where we are. You cannot tell me that there aren't parents who, you know, and some teachers, by the way, who aren't happy to go back. I know there are because I hear from them. The Tribune writes it as if these teachers feel they're being sent, you know, to their death chambers.
No parents come forward to say, "Oh, I'm so happy my kids are coming back in school," because they don't want to upset the union. Because that's how much control they have over everything in this state.
Guess what? Neither does the Tribune. I mean, the Tribune is the comm shop for the union, they're the comm shop for the Democrat Party. When you say this is where we're at, you're talking about this is where we're at with the media. And that's exactly it. It's not, even if parents were to come forward, they're not interested. So they're not looking for parents to come forward. They're looking to be the filter for the teachers union to the public.
Right. Well, I can't say what I said to Quinn, so I'll just say what a mess.
Alex Berenson, former New York Times reporter, author of the number one bestseller, pick up his stuff, Amazon.com, Unreported Truths About COVID-19 and Lockdowns, combined parts 1 through 3, death counts, lockdowns, and masks. And you told Rogan you might have one forthcoming on vaccines as well.
Actually, I think it's time for one on vaccines. Let's hope that sort of the quiet rebellion continues. I mean, I think you're right. We're not seeing a loud
you know, loud rebellion right now. But I do think people have had enough. A lot of people have had enough.
Thanks for joining us, Alex. Appreciate it.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Listen to AM 560 The Answer online at 560theanswer.com on the AM 560 mobile app and your Alexa powered smart speaker on TuneIn, iHeart, and radio.com.
From the Matrix Home Solutions studios, this is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560 The Answer.
Welcome back, Dan and Amy. We didn't get to it yesterday, but we'll get to it right now. And that was Representative Emanuel Cleaver's prayer to open the 117th Congress.
Many different faiths, a man and a woman.
A man and a woman.
Wait,
coming
what did
to
he say?
A Methodist church near you. Amen and a woman. Of course, amen is Latin. It translates to so be it.
Oh, I was going to tell you that.
Amen. A woman, so a woman translates in Latin to so be it unless I change my mind. Hi-oh. Yeah.
And I have a right to change my mind because I'm a woman. Get it?
Now, Emanuel Cleaver, his foray into linguistics is not new. You may remember about 9 years ago, he was the gentleman who authored this characterization of a debt ceiling deal.
Very accurate quote. What I'm saying is that if you lift the bond, what you see is antithetical to everything the great religions of the world teach, which is take care of the poor, take care of the aged. And when you look at the phone calls I've gotten, they're 7 to 1 in favor of a balanced deal and also preserving Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security. And I'm concerned about this because we don't know the details. And until we see the details, we're going to be extremely non-committed. But on the surface, it looks like a Satan sandwich.
Oh, remember Satan sandwich?
Oh, that's right.
He called Satan sandwich because he didn't want a debt ceiling.
Right.
He wanted to raise the debt ceiling cap, but he didn't want the associated spending cuts for the purposes of deficit reduction. Of course not. Satan sandwich. So now we've moved on into sort of the full identitarian lexicon of the left in 2020, 2021 America. And it's amen and a woman. This
I'm not
is consistent.
Willing to do that because, you know, that's going to come to my church. When and if we ever reopen, because they're, you know, so woke. You know, they put the little flags out there on the lawn for everyone who in Cook County who died from COVID. And
right. You know, woke meaning, woke being synonymous with ignorance, which is the position of somebody who would suggest that amen is gendered. But anyway, this is consistent with the new rules changes on language in the House. The part of the House rules package, quoting here, strike father, mother, son, daughter, brother, sister, uncle, aunt, first cousin, nephew, niece, husband, wife, father-in-law, mother-in-law, son-in-law, daughter-in-law, brother-in-law, sister-in-law, stepfather, stepmother, stepson, stepdaughter, stepbrother, stepsister, half-brother, half-sister, grandson, and granddaughter. Insert parent, child, sibling. Parents, sibling, first cousin, sibling's child, spouse, parent-in-law, child-in-law, sibling-in-law,
spend time on this?
Step-parent, stepchild, step-sibling, half-sibling, or grandchild. Strike himself or herself, insert themselves. Part of the language protocols in the House. Part of, you know of Mao's Cultural Revolution. Let's call this Ma's Cultural Revolution, as in Ma Pelosi. Mm-hmm. So we were talking about the madness of herds when it came to COVID, things like lockdown policies and school closures. What about the madness of herds when it comes to language, when it comes to the LGBTQ identitarianism?
Right, this is madness. Donald Trump Jr. said it best, amen and a woman. It tells you everything you need to know about the Democratic Party. These people are freaking morons.
Yeah, it's not just the Democratic Party. Sorry. It's, it goes a little deeper than you know, the Trump Jr. Is wont to go. It goes actually back to, I would go back to Emerson, and I'm no Emersonian transcendentalist. But in 1836, in his treatise, Nature, specifically on language, Emerson observed, "The corruption of man is followed by the corruption of language. When simplicity of character and the sovereignty of ideas is broken up by the prevalence of secondary desires, the desire of riches, of pleasure, of power, and of praise, and duplicity and falsehood take place of sympathy of simplicity and truth." Right. The corruption of man followed by the corruption of language. That's where we're at.
Well,
and he was correct about using about words being properly used to convey natural facts and being corrupted when used otherwise. So that's what's happening. Words are corrupted when used otherwise, when used to serve secondary desires, riches, pleasure, power, praise. That's where we're at.
Taking away the word mother. Nancy Pelosi better change her, you know, Twitter profile, because she describes herself as a mother, grandmother, and a dark chocolate connoisseur, Dan.
Oh, and I've seen the refrigerators.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, no question.
So you know.
312-642-5600,
turnkey.pro. Answer line 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment. I'm
Why
never going to stop calling. What do they want next? Our kids to stop calling us mom and dad and uncle and aunt and cousins? Because these are real things. These are nouns. These are people.
Well, one of the things they want you to do is be forced to pay for the sex change operation of a convicted rapist. U.S. District Judge James Peterson approved the request of Mark Allen Campbell, 49-year-old Wisconsin man who identifies as female and goes by the name Nicole Rose, to undergo transgender surgery at taxpayer expense. Campbell has identified as female since 2013 when he first requested the operation.
Too bad.
Well,
people are going to have to pay for this? Seriously?
U.S. District Judge James Peterson approved the request to undergo transgender surgery at taxpayer expense, so reports the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel.
It's about $100,000 plus.
The dollar amount is sort of a secondary issue to the event itself,
just
isn't
letting
it?
You know. Yeah, I mean, it's not a cheap operation. It's not a cheap process.
Where does this go? Let's see. Here's the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel coverage of this. Because the media here, again, in terms of fomenting the madness of the herd. Three graphs. A federal judge has ordered the state to provide long-sought gender confirmation surgery to a transgender female inmate, which would make her the first in Wisconsin to have the procedure while in state custody. Oh, it sounds like they're striking a blow for trans rights or something, doesn't it? U.S. District Judge James Peterson writing in his opinion, "The rights of transgender persons and sex reassignment surgery remain politically controversial even outside the prison context. Some members of the public are outraged at any effort to improve the health and well-being of inmates. But the true public interest lies in alleviating needless suffering by those who are dependent on the government for their care, like he's in a Medicaid-funded nursing home." Peterson's order followed a three-day bench trial in March, and in the case of Nicole Campbell, also known as Mark Campbell. In 2007, Nicole Campbell, don't call me Mark, began serving a 34-year sentence for sexual assault of a child. That's graph four there. They never include this detail. The 34-year prison sentence he began serving in 2007 for sexual assault of a child. You know who the child was?
No.
His 10-year-old daughter.
Ah, God.
So Judge Peterson saying
that. He's not factoring that into account. He's rewarding him for that bad, sick, disgusting behavior.
You know, he's, I'm sure Judge Peterson would say, well, that, you know, this gender That's dysphoria right. he was suffering from, this is exactly why he was very sick individual, and now the state is going to make him better by indulging his fantasy of being a woman. But I shouldn't care about that, because people can just say and do whatever they want, and what does it impact me? Right? If you don't support gay marriage, don't get gay married. But bump. Redefine institutions. Redefine gender identity. Live the my truth culture. What's the problem? Right? So what's the problem with Nancy Pelosi polluting the language as it pertains to legislation or communiques from that august body, the House of Representatives? What's the problem here? Anything? No? I'm just going to the madness of the herd. And one by one, not in time, this will be visited upon people in a way that's material, so they see that they're not allowed to ignore it. Just as they have seen, perhaps, some of them, they weren't allowed to just go about their daily life. You'll be forced to celebrate it. You'll be forced to finance it. Already happening. What does it matter? Does it? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line. John in Shorewood, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hello.
Hey, John.
Dan, Amy, great talking yes. to you. I'm a little confused. We got a guy who wants to become a woman, but then do we call him a woman or we call a man? Confused on the gender, but I don't know what to call him. And then getting back to the congressman, I'm sorry, the congressperson, I guess, I don't know. Hmm. But I see the biggest problem we have in this country, and of course the dumbing down of America, but the lack of discernment. How many people have heard him say a man and a woman? But she shouldn't be saying a woman anyways, I guess, now on the floor of the Congress. But the lack of discernment that goes, that people don't realize what, like you said earlier, amen means so be it. You know, the prayer is lifted up to the Lord, so be it. And now a woman, people just brush right past it. Nobody takes the time to discern of what's going on. These kids are not taught how to discern. They believe whatever they read on Twitter.
Thanks for the call. Yeah, it's, I mean, it's all sentimentality. It's all, which is to say, barbarism. Yeah. And again, one of my favorite observations from Flannery O'Connor, that sentimentality ultimately, words to this effect, ultimately ends in the gas chamber. But the good news is, before you go to the gas chamber, you get taxpayer financed gender reassignment surgery. This is Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
Download the AM560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.